1 week from today marks the one-year anniversary of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire's student newspaper, The Spectator, breaking a story that would cause ripples at the school for days and weeks to follow. They shared photos of social media posts by members of the Blue Gold football team directing racially charged comments and images toward the Black Male Empowerment Group on campus. On-campus protests followed, and a task force was quickly formed to recommend new policies to improve equity and inclusion for minority groups. So, where are things now, a year later? Have things improved? And what effect has the summer of George Floyd and Jacob Blake had? And what effect has the pandemic had? Equity, diversity, and inclusion efforts at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire is our topic today on the West Side. Good morning. I'm Dean Kallenbeck. As I mentioned, race relations at UWR-Eau Claire, a primary topic today, and our guests will be students Yusra Bentala, Madeline Furstenberg, faculty member Salika Duxworth-Lawton, and Vice Chancellor Warren Anderson. They'll all join us in a few minutes to focus on that topic. But before we have that conversation, I want to turn our attention to a story that broke yesterday involving UW-Eau Claire, as well as UW-Stout in Menominee and UW-River Falls. Those campuses will not be bringing students back into the classroom after the Thanksgiving break due to the surge in COVID-19 cases in western Wisconsin. Our Eau Claire-based reporter Rich Kramer covers higher education for WPR, and he joins us now for a few minutes to update us. Rich, good morning.
Good morning, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so there have been hints of this sort of action as early as this summer. What triggered this now by the three West Central Wisconsin UW campuses?
Well, in a nutshell, it's cases and capacity at hospitals. There was a Zoom meeting, a press conference type sort of a thing with UW-Eau Claire Chancellor. Warren Anderson was there as well. And the discussion centered around their decision to move classes online. It had been a possibility all through the planning stages. And we've seen other campuses like UW-Madison said pretty early on that in this fall semester that they were going to do that. But what happened locally, the plan was, and Chancellor Schmidt said as late as Tuesday, the plan was to have classes remain online after Thanksgiving. But what we're seeing at hospitals in northwestern Wisconsin just became untenable, he said. As has been reported, the Mayo Clinic, Marshfield Clinic, Sacred Heart, they're all reporting that they're very close to or at capacity. Mayo said earlier this week, even though it feels like a month ago, that they are at 100%. Their beds are 100% full. And so that, Chancellor Schmidt said that was the one of the major factors that pushed them to move classes online after Thanksgiving. The idea is to kind of curb some of that travel. The other thing is that the chancellor and those in those other campuses are urging students not to travel for Thanksgiving. If they do, they have to pass or they have to test negative twice upon returning to campus, test negative using these antigen 15-minute tests. So it's just getting pretty serious out there, he says, in terms of the hospital capacity, and they don't want to contribute to that burden.
Yeah, as opposed to the quick turnaround from in-person to virtual classes that hit this spring, schools now have had more time to prepare for this eventuality. How will virtual learning look different this fall than it did in the spring of 2020?
Well, I don't have like direct access to what the classes looked like. I did talk to some students, as they were returning to Eau Claire in the fall. I also called to campuses in Milwaukee and Madison, and some of the students didn't mind the online. Some of them didn't like it, especially students that had some lab work. I talked to a chemistry student who what he normally would do in person had to be done online, just using formulas and stuff. And he said it's not the same. And he even said that it could impact, if it happened again this fall, in terms of the whole semester being online, he said that could have impacted internship opportunities. But I think the major difference that I can kind of see from the outside is that they've been through this before. The faculty, the staff, all the people designing curriculum have had to weather this storm before. And I know that UW system as a whole, I don't know the specifics for Eau Claire or Stout or River Falls, but there was some money put into training for professors over the summer to kind of help them design more effective online courses, because it's a whole different animal than teaching in person.
So classes won't be happening on those campuses, River Falls, Stout, and Eau Claire. Does that mean everything will be shut down there?
No, that's another major difference from what we saw in the fall. The Chancellor Schmidt said that all campus, you know, will be open, dining, residence halls, all kinds of student services are going to continue. So that it's not going to be like in the spring when the campuses essentially became ghost towns and people were told to leave and go home. And that's actually the reason I asked the chancellor yesterday, well, if students decide to travel home and since classes are online, they don't want to come back, will there be any refunds for the remainder of the their housing contracts, you know, in the dormitories? And he said no, because those services still exist. Like in the spring, they essentially told students who had the ability to go home, so that ended the contract, and there were refunds done, which was a major financial hit to the universities too.
Well, speaking of that, does this decision cast a shadow on the possibility of in-person learning at the campuses for spring semester?
You know, from my perspective, it's too early to tell, but what I've heard, I believe the chancellor mentioned this yesterday, that there's some optimism for the spring semester, that it'll be just kind of less tumultuous than it was this year. You know, a lot of people in higher education are kind of, this is mainly going to like recruitment and admissions people, but the enrollment has been down across the board, not only in Wisconsin, but nationwide, because a lot of students, especially new freshmen, are kind of wondering if they should have jumped in this fall, and that some of them decided not to, especially at two-year community colleges. But what I'm hearing from tech colleges, you know, UW campuses and private colleges, is the tea leaves for next semester are looking pretty good. You know, there's a lot of optimism that a potential vaccine could kind of start getting things back to normal. And because the economy is not, it's still down from what it was in the spring, there's a thought that could actually move people to go to decide to go to college. I mean, that's what we see, especially at the two-year technical colleges, is enrollment surges whenever there is a economic downturn. So there's a lot of optimism for spring, though, of course, you know, nobody can predict the future.
Yeah. Hey, Rich, thanks for dropping in on short notice with that update.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Dean.
Rich Kramer is WPR's higher education reporter based in Eau Claire. So we're back for the rest of the hour with our primary topic, a revisit of race relations at UW-Eau Claire. And once again, our guests are Madeline Furstenberg. She's a UW-Eau Claire fourth-year student and former editor-in-chief of the student newspaper The Spectator. She's the journalist who broke the story on the football group chat and continues to be a freelance writer for The Spectator. Madeline Furstenberg, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yusra Bentala is also with us today. She's another UW-Eau Claire student. She co-chaired the Rapid Action Task Force for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity, otherwise known as RAFT. The task force made recommendations to UW-Eau Claire's Chancellor James Schmidt in regards to the university's EDI plan. Yusra Bentala, great to have you with us today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Salika Duxworth-Lawton is with us as well. She's a history and women's gender and sexuality studies professor at UW-Eau Claire, also a member of the executive board for the American Civil Liberties Union, representing the Chippewa Valley chapter to the state organization, and she's a leader in the Uniting Bridges community organization of the Chippewa Valley. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, welcome back to the West Side.
Glad to be here. Honored to be here.
And also with us, Warren Anderson. He is UW-Eau Claire's Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity. Warren Anderson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
So as usual, you're welcome to join the conversation, and you can do so by phone at 800-228-5615 or via email at ideas@wpr.org. That's 800-228-5615 or ideas@wpr.org. So, Madeline Furstenberg, I want to start with you. Your reporting broke the original story about the Snapchat incident with the members of the football team a year ago this month. For the sake of background, take us through how you came upon that story and what followed on campus.
Yeah, so one of the members of the Black Male Empowerment Group and a former football player had shared images of this conversation that had occurred on social media. Those images quickly circulated across different platforms and came across my social media, and we knew immediately that this was a story that needed to be covered. So I contacted the players and sat down with a few former players and BME members who had a lot to say about racism on the team and also the incident itself. So we got that story out, I think, the next day, and it had a huge response. I think of all the big stories we covered last year, it was probably the most impactful for students because it led to protests and a march, and it had a really huge chain reaction.
So we're not going to spend the whole show living in the past, but I do think it's important to get a sense of the impact of those Snapchat posts and the Snapchat incident to set the stage for the rest of the conversation. Yusra Bentala, you were a third-year student at the time the story broke. What was your response personally?
Personally, I think it was really sad to see that this is the kind of culture that was around the university. At a predominantly white university, you know, you're not going to expect a lot of things, but you don't expect worst-case scenarios to come, especially from people you would consider, you know, friends or acquaintances, some of the people in my classes, you know. So it was just very shocking to see that this kind of language is still continuing on in 2019.
Salika Duxworth-Lawton, you came on our show the week after the Snapchat story broke to share your concerns as a faculty member of color. What were your primary concerns after hearing about the football player's comments directed at that Black Male Empowerment Group?
I mean, and I'm speaking here with other Black faculty. We mm-hmm. were worried about how many other people were sharing those types of attitudes. And those people being in our classes, those people menacing our students. Mainly, we were reacting to the students. On one hand, the multicultural faculty, and especially the Black faculty, were the ones that students turned to for support, along with the multicultural staff and Office of Multicultural Affairs. So we had to be very strong for the students, and we also had to articulate the problem with the language and the way it made people worry that they actually would carry out something like that, or there were people there who would be encouraged to violence. On the other hand, that meant there was Vice Chancellor Anderson wasn't here yet, so this is not on him. There was really no one to hear us at that moment in time because the office was vacant.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult. Faculty were especially worried because the uncertainty of the response, the fact that we had to learn about it from the press, we didn't get emails ahead of time. The executive team had been in flux because of not having certain positions filled. And that created a lot of uncertainty and distrust.
Warren Anderson, as Professor Duxworth-Lawton mentioned, you had not yet been hired as vice chancellor, or you had been hired by as vice chancellor, but hadn't started your employment with UW-Eau Claire as the vice chancellor for equity, diversity, and inclusion when this controversy blew up. You stepped into quite a challenging start.
Well, I've been doing this work for over 20 years, so I didn't see it as terribly challenging at all. Actually, quite the opposite. Prior to me coming, I'd had a number of conversations with the chancellor about the steps he was going to take with it. Again, having done this work for such a long time, I'd seen terrible atrocities targeted at student and employee populations at a number of institutions, and every institution handled it differently. When I came in, one of the things that I set out to do immediately was really set the tone of expectation of what could and should happen. I did not want this one incident to come across as being the one negative thing that was happening here, that it's the only thing that has happened to a targeted population here. That was not the case. So we wanted to make sure that everyone involved in this not only had an opportunity to express their dismay with this, but also chart out a path to move forward. And that included the students who were alleged to have committed this incident, going through the student conduct process that was laid out. That took an extremely long amount of time. But one of the things that has been brought up a number of times is this aspect of trust, because the community was not made aware of every single step in this case. That's never the case whenever we talk about student conduct issues, because student privacy rights are there. And I think that's the one thing that individuals try to use as a crutch to say, well, we're hiding behind that. Fact of the matter is that same level of privacy that protects those students is the same that protects every other student, faculty, or staff member at the institution who's charged with something. I wanted to just make sure that the process was done fairly and equitably, and at the other side of that, that we had a plan in place to not only hold students accountable who violated that, but set a tone of reconciliation that allows the institution to move forward.
That's the voice of Warren Anderson. He is the Vice Chancellor of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Also with us on the program today, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, the Professor of History and Women's and Gender and Sexuality Studies at UW-Eau Claire. Yusra Bentala, she was a student co-chair of a rapid area task force that dealt with issues of equity, diversity, and inclusion. We'll talk about that coming out of the break. And Madeline Furstenberg, student journalist for The Spectator, the student newspaper at UW-Eau Claire. You can join the conversation with your questions or comments. Ideas at WPR.org is an easy way to do it. Send an email to ideas at WPR.org or give us a call at 800-228-5615. We have a line open, 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach. We're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, specifically at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, 1 year after the school made national headlines following the revelation of racist Snapchat posts by members of the Blue Gold football team. In response to that incident last November, Chancellor James Schmidt formed what he named a Rapid Action Task Force on Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. Yusra Bentala, you were co-chair of that group. Talk about that group's charge, if you would.
Yeah, so that is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, essentially, was that I wanted to clarify that the EDI Rapid Action Task Force, at no time, you know, like, we were just charged with essentially reviewing current University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Bearing County strategic plans and its implementation outcomes, as well as the recommendations made by university students, faculty, and staff. And then after consultation with relevant stakeholders, we were charged with identifying specific and immediate actions that could be implemented by the end of the academic year, which was 2019.
Your group was formed in early December with a report due at the beginning of February. How'd you go about gathering the information in such a tight timeline, especially since during most of those weeks, school was on winter break?
Yeah, so some of those, we essentially met on Zoom a lot with everything happening with COVID, everything happening over the break, but we gathered, we made you know, a Qualtrics survey, so it was open to faculty, students, staff, people at the university were able to give their impact or input on that. And then from there, we made some recommendations. We also looked over, as I stated, the previous strategic plans that were already implemented. We also looked at budget and shared governance implications for the recommendations. We looked at the University Senate resolution on improving retention of faculty, staff, and students of color at the university. Again, the campus survey. We looked at campus office reporting protocol, and we also looked at the letter from the Office of Multicultural Affairs to the chancellor and the Black male empowerment demands.
So the task force came up with 9 recommendations. Yusra Bentala, in your mind as co-chair representing students, what were the key recommendations coming from the Rapid Action Task Force?
So we kind of wanted to, my section of co-chair, the section that I had, was kind of just culture in regard to the university as a whole, as well as like the student aspect. We wanted to see what we could do for students to kind of get them more involved, to kind of improve the culture and see what we could do. You know, like there's trainings for faculty and staff, so we wanted to give that chance for students if they wanted to have that.
Warren Anderson, as Vice Chancellor, how has UW-Eau Claire administration responded to the recommendations that came out in the report in February?
Thank you. That's a great question. We looked at all of the recommendations that was a result of the great work from the implementation team, many of which we were already implementing and working on. Following that, I convened an implementation team to look at where we were with bringing a number of those recommendations into play. And, of course, then COVID hit, which sort of slowed a number of things down, but it didn't completely stop the work that we're doing. The Rapid Action Task Force and the recommendations that they gave, the main recommendation that they suggested was the implementation of restorative justice and restorative practices, specifically within the student conduct process. As we went through and looked at the outcomes of this case, specifically the student conduct process, it was evident that restorative justice was exactly what should have been employed in this process from the beginning. We sought out to implement restorative justice with all members of the football team, and that's the one thing I want to be sure that we hit on. Regardless of what anyone thinks of this situation, the students that shared the post, those were students. They do not represent all of the football team. They do not represent all of intercollegiate athletics here. More than any other school I've been at and have had the privilege of leading this work, the football team especially took it difficult with the individuals that perpetrated this. So it's difficult to go into the details about what's happened and what is currently happening, but what I can tell you is that the recommendations from the Rapid Action Task Force were phenomenal recommendations, and we're still working to implement all of them in everyday practice here. But we also have to remember that the recommendations went far beyond students and far beyond this case. They are really working to change the entire footprint of the university, and we have to remember that while this one incident was sort of a spark for a lot of what happened here, it is not the only thing that was happening that went against the principles of EDI that were established, both in and out of the classroom. We have to rectify and jump in whenever we can. One of the things I say all the time here at the university is we can't be selective activists. While we were outraged with this incident, there were a number of other incidents that we should have focused on just as much, but we didn't. And that is a failure of the entire university as we look to really build a culture of equity, inclusion here at the university and go far beyond diversity. So it's important that we really look at the recommendations of the Rapid Action Task Force as a starting point for how we're really going to go about setting the culture of the institution for generations to come.
Salika Duxworth-Lawton, I know one of your concerns regarding the November 2019 Snapchat incident was how long it took for official communication to finally reach faculty and students. You talked about it earlier in the show. One of the recommendations of the task force was to improve crisis communication relating to racist incidents. Have you seen progress in that area?
Well, part of our problem is we lost this summer our university communications director. Paula, who is the new lady, is wonderful, and I think that one of the first things she's doing is revamping our crisis communications. So I expect as we go forward, we're going to see better communication, more lead time, and more trust for faculty and staff, because it's very hard for us to learn, as yesterday we learned about the university going online from the press. So I expect that will not be happening in the future. I think that there are some other things, though, where we need to, faculty, staff, and the administration need to work harder to make sure the administration knows what we down below are thinking, so that they don't get into a bubble where they are reinforcing their own ideas and don't realize what the impact of those ideas are on us who are in the classroom and in the offices. And I know that that's something that Peter Hart Brinson and Evan Wire from University Senate want to work on. To open up more lines of communication, I think, will be one of the best things that we would be able to do. Right now, even with the reforms we have, faculty and staff still feel somewhat unheard. And that our concerns have not really been addressed adequately or even thought of. And I know that some of the BME gentlemen who I have talked to feel are not happy with the way this process has gone. So we've got a lot of work to do, and I expect that with goodwill we will go forward.
That's Professor Salika Duxworth-Lawton. We're also speaking with Vice Chancellor Warren Anderson and UW-Eau Claire students Yusra Bentala and Madeline Furstenberg about race relations at UW-Eau Claire, revisiting the topic on the one-year anniversary or near the one-year anniversary of the story breaking about racist Snapchats posted by members of the UW-Eau Claire football team. Now, this fall, and the Spectator again, one more thing, if you're interested in joining this conversation, 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615, or email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So in September, the Spectator again broke a story relating to the football players, this time revealing that the people involved in the Snapchat incident were not only reinstated to the university, but to the football team. Madeline Furstenberg, how did you and your reporters at The Spectator learn about that reinstatement?
So one of the captains of the Blue Gold football team has sent out an email to university coaches, basically explaining that these players were being allowed back on the team, but it was not their decision. It was not the athletic department's decision. And they were not happy with this decision. This email was, of course, passed around and eventually came to me and a few of the other editors at The Spectator. And we, you know, immediately jumped into action, spoke with the football players. We tried to contact university administration. We, you know, made open records law requests. From there, it just kind of spiraled.
And the Rapid Action Task Force on EDI was supposed to be done with its work after issuing its report in February, but it did gather again to respond to the reinstatement of the football players. Yusra Bentala, the full committee signed that letter, and as co-chair, your name was at the top. What was that response of the task force?
Yeah, I also think we were not happy with the findings. That was another thing that we wanted to clarify, that the EDI Rapid Action Task Force, and, you know, at no time had any oversight over the administration's efforts to investigate the incident involving the five Blue Gold football team members. And I also believe that some people in the community think that the force was the committee that found no wrongdoing under the administrative code. You know, that's when we had sent the final statement. In fact, the university had refused to reveal the membership of the committee or its specific charge, in which case our task force sent the letter after the administration's announcement detailed our disappointment with the lack of transparency in notifying the university community and the absence of restorative justice at the time.
Vice Chancellor Anderson, can you bring some clarity to the conversation and explain who and how the reinstatement decision was made?
I would love to. In my opinion, and again, I have the privilege of coming in after all of this had started and was progressing, there is a fundamental understanding of not only the process, but what the expectations are. And let me address a couple things, and then I want to get into some of the good things we're doing. The first thing is the students were never suspended from the university or the football program. And in my estimation, and I share this with the chancellor from the very beginning of when I was told about this, at no institution in this country would these students have faced the kind of retribution that a number of members of this institution were calling for. Simply would not have happened. As we go through, those members were suspended from the football team pending the outcome of the student conduct process. Once the student conduct process played out and the panel found them not responsible for violating institutional policies because they didn't, there was no way to go back and then retroactively carry out any other sanctions against them. In response to the statements that have been shared that this was the administration's decision to allow them back on the football team or to sort of let them off, these students were held accountable based on the statute that all students are held accountable for, which is the Blue Gold Code, the Student Code of Conduct. It is not our place to go in and say that the committee that was convened to handle this and to hear this, that they did something wrong, and we're going to jump in and just change what they said. If individuals have an issue with the outcome of this case, then we need to work to explore ways to make changes to Chapter 17, which is the system-wide code of conduct. That, I think, is the first part. The statement that went out from the Rapid Action Task Force when the decision was reached, it's correct. They had nothing to do with the outcome, nor did the administration. But what was interesting and what I spent a lot of time sort of diffusing with campus constituents is the decision to implement restorative justice in this case, that was the main recommendation from the Rapid Action Task Force. We can't be selective in when we decide to employ restorative justice only in those instances where we don't agree with the outcome. Restorative justice was employed simply because that was the best course of action, and it's also in line with the recommendation from the Rapid Action Task Force. So again, we have to be consistent in how and when we apply these things. In terms of communications for all of these things, again, my stance has always been there has to be some understanding of when you can expect communication and when you shouldn't. There is no case, whether or not there are charges against students or cases where faculty are charged with wrongdoing or staff are charged with wrongdoing, that we share with the entire community every single step of that. We can't have one-way transparency. We can't say these students should be nailed to a wall, but when an employee does something, we jump behind privacy and strict privacy for an employee. That can't be the case, and it won't be the case under me. We have taken some steps. I know the team that I have, the phenomenal members of this university, specifically those that are in EDI and Student Affairs, we've worked to build some really good things. we just introduced the Center for Racial and Restorative Justice that speaks to a lot of the things that we talked about today. We're looking at doing faculty and student research around the concepts of racial justice, restorative justice, and things all along that spectrum. We're really looking to build an environment that we can all be proud of. Mistakes happen in this case. They happen in every case that we have. We're working to implement a campus and secure a campus that protects our students from all forms of bias, whether they be related to race, gender, orientation, or what have you. This has to be comprehensive, and it has to be done right. So we're taking the steps in the most concerted way possible, and it's going to take all of us to do it. The one thing we can't do, and the one thing that I know I have little patience for, is continuing to point the blame and focus on the ire of a decision that was made from an incident that happened a year ago that causes us to lose focus on all the good things that are happening at this institution. And that's where I really want to point all of this conversation is we are doing some really amazing things here at this university, some things that are really going to set us apart, not only statewide, but nationally. And I hope that becomes the focus of these stories moving forward and not continuing to sort of debate the outcomes of specific cases that members of the community simply didn't like. There are a lot of institutions that I've been at and some things that have happened here that I'm not happy with the outcome of, but I recognize it's part of a culture that we have to change, and I do hope that the entire community gets behind the change that we're trying to create here.
Before we go to break, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, the administration is really between a rock and a hard place in this tug of war between confidentiality and transparency relating to racist occurrences among staff, or faculty, students. What's the answer to that as far as, is there a satisfying answer when it comes to protecting the rights of those who've been accused as well as the needs of the community and the campus?
Well, first off, one of the things we have to do is an examination of what went wrong. And really, we should have waited before we moved on this case. And to be honest, half the lawyers in town have been jumping down my throat, and I had nothing to do with it, about why weren't the Black male empowerment students told that they could press criminal charges? Because this behavior violates Wisconsin Administrative Code 947. Which is the harassment code. And then it wouldn't have had anything to do with free speech, and it wouldn't have been on campus. So we have to have a hard conversation on what the university legally can respond to and what the university cannot respond to. Does that make sense? The BME gentleman would like for the campus's version of the Blue Go Code, which we control, to be amended to include not just UWS-17 and UWS-18, but to include Wisconsin Administrative Code 947, so that harassment that happens to anybody, regardless of race, gender, class, etc., will be actionable on campus. Now, that is one step in the right direction, but we're going to have to understand that some things that are below threshold, the campus cannot, the university cannot always address them. But at that point in time, we need to make sure that it goes to the outside entities who can actually address them. Does that make sense? We have to recognize the university cannot always handle some of the bad behavior that we see. Now, the second thing is that I do think that the young men have gotten penalties. They have been taught that there are lines you don't cross. They thought this was joking, and other people are going, no, you're threatening. So that was a hard way to learn that lesson. We have to think in a more unified way about how we're going to work with the community and work with the students to talk about a shared definition of what civility looks like. And at the center of that discussion, we really need faculty and staff, because while students will come and go, faculty and staff stay. And we're the ones who will be enforcing those norms.
We're talking about race relations at UW-Eau Claire. That was the voice of Salika Duxworth-Lawton, professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at UW-Eau Claire. Also with us, Vice Chancellor for EDI, Warren Anderson, Yusra Bentala, student co-chair of the Rapid Action Task Force, and Madeline Furstenberg, student journalist for the UW-Eau Claire newspaper, The Spectator. If you want to talk about race in the Chippewa Valley, call 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615, or email ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're talking about race relations at UW-Eau Claire and efforts to improve equity, diversity, and inclusion on that campus. The issue of racism has become front and center nationwide after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, you've helped organize peaceful protests to those incidents and to racism overall this past summer. Have you seen that new attention to the issue affect what's happening on campus?
Yes and no. I think that students are more aware and they are more interested. We definitely are getting a different set of questions in our classes, if they are classes about, say, mine, African-American history. But I've also seen a doubling down by people who feel, they feel threatened by the loss of social power. They feel that the stereotypes of criminality are accurate, and we need to address that in the way those stereotypes are used to create environments that corruptly excuse the abuse of rights. So we've got education to do, and we're going, and this loss of civics education in the high schools means that we're also teaching them how the government works and that it doesn't have a racial overlay over it. So we sit in interesting times. Isn't that the Yiddish curse.
Mm-hmm. May you live in interesting times. Yeah. Yusra Bentala, I'm wondering, do you feel any greater sense of urgency among students on campus for EDI coming out of this past summer's situation, including all the protests relating to the George Floyd and Jacob Blake incidents?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit difficult due to the COVID situation to kind of really get a pull on how everyone is feeling about it. But on the basis of social media, I see a lot of outpour towards it. But you also see, you know, a lot of those people, like Dr. Duxworth just stated, a lot of these people are, you know, like really ground in their way of thought, in their like way of thinking. They think, you know, like, oh, what, I guess not in opposition of it, but not in favor, not in support of the protests. And they have their own opinions on what protests will lead to and, like, destruction. And that's all they see instead of the message and, like, the oppression of centuries of oppression. And they can't really, like, justify that with the protests. They can't understand the anger that people have, which is very sad to see, because I think this all stems from a place of not understanding and not being able to kind of be able to relate because they've never been in those situations before.
We heard earlier in the show from WPR reporter Rich Kramer that the university will be going virtual after Thanksgiving. Vice Chancellor Anderson, I'm wondering how that impacts your efforts to take on the recommendations of the Rapid Action Task Force and frankly, any of your efforts toward equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus?
Well, it absolutely educates it, if you will. It doesn't stop it. COVID doesn't stop what we're doing. Again, many of the recommendations that came out of the Rapid Action Task Force were things that my team and I were already working on. The education has to be paramount. One of the things that was said earlier and has been said consistently is the term harassment. That is the first and foremost area where we need to have a lot more education on and off campus. I also oversee the work around Title IX on campus. So when you talk about civil rights investigations and things like that, which all of these things fall under, severe and pervasive comes in. Sharing one picture online does not in and of itself constitute harassment. But because individuals across campus have said that word many times, any incident where someone simply disagrees with someone who happens to be a member of a targeted population, that word seems to be thrown around a lot, which causes a lot of issues. My hope, and it's been my hope since I walked through the door, is that we can responsibly address situations when they happen, and we can responsibly work with our students, faculty, and staff to address them. We need to make sure that the work that we're doing, including creating the center, focusing more on research that goes and is rooted in a true sense of what's happening not only now in society, but the commonalities that happened, say, in the civil rights movements or in periods prior to that. Education has to be supplemented by all the work of EDI. We can't just talk about EDI when we have a matchstick moment. We have to work to incorporate EDI into everything we do, both in and out of the classroom, in our administrative processes, and in our everyday work. I have the privilege of leading a dedicated group of individuals who work on training, who work on infusing these things into the curriculum, but who also work on the administrative side to make sure that everything we do, not only for our students of color, but for our majority students, is rooted in equity and fairness. And so that when our students graduate, they walk across that stage, their degree means more than what they got in the academic classroom, that they have a full understanding of multiculturalism in its broadest sense. That's going to empower them in the diverse workforce they're going into. We have a phenomenal educational experience here for our students, and we just want to make sure that what we do, the environment and culture that we're building on campus, is fully mired in the work of true EDI and a fundamental understanding of the individual and how they play a part in where they exist in the society. So what's happening in society absolutely informs the work that we do on campus, but that's just the start. One of the things that I've said this summer, and I've said more and more, is we have to be, we can't just respond to inequities in society by just words. We have to have action behind that. And I think the work that we're doing, what we're currently doing and what we will be doing, is rooted in action, but we're going to need everybody to pitch in, but do it responsibly.
Thank you to our guests today, Vice Chancellor Warren Anderson for Equity. He's the Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at UW-Eau Claire. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at UW-Eau Claire. Yusor Bentala, a senior psychology student who's going to be one of those graduating people in the spring. And Madeline Furstenberg, who is a senior journalism student at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Today's program was produced by Bailey Rieger-Bohr. Catherine Thomas was our on-air producer. Patrick Eikens and Kate Spranger handle publicity and archives. Sue Johnson and Bonnie Clark are our transcriptionists. Next week, we gather the latest on the pandemic surge and how local communities are responding, plus a look ahead to the gun deer season. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dean Kallenbeck. This is The West Side on the Ideas Network.